Hello and welcome to this special bonus episode of Millions of Screens. What follows is our complete interview with Rob McElhenney, the star and co-creator of Mythic Quest, on comedy versus drama, his unique relationship with fellow showrunner Megan Ganz, and the feedback he'd gotten from the writers' rooms of both Breaking Bad and Mad Men during It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia's still ongoing run. Also, Rob turns the tables on Ben and Libby to ask about their dissenting opinions on Backstory, the standalone episode from Mythic Quest's second season. It's also worth noting that this entire interview came about after Libby tweeted about Rob's appearance on Seth Meyers a couple of weeks ago, which you'll hear us talking about in the intro. And now, without further ado, our interview with Rob McElhenney.
It is millions and millions of little screens.
Can't you shut up? I'm busy. Boy, what a great show.
But yeah, I think this all sort of stemmed from Libby's tweets. I think we kind of maybe wanted to start there and just sort of start the conversation about comedy versus drama and then sort of work our way through Mythic Quest season two and sort of any other questions that Ben and Libby or I might throw out there to you.
Sure. Well, let me pull up Libby's. Let me pull up.
Oh, tweets. I don't good. Have this is exactly how I hoped this would go.
Oh, okay. Here we go. I got it.
Damn it.
Okay, I got it. All right. Okay. So, because I'm such a big fan of IndieWire and a big fan of Libby, I follow Libby on social media. And so I woke up one morning and saw this. This is posted at 11:42 p.m. To preserve my enjoyment of MQ, I should probably stop ingesting interviews with Rob McElhenney. And I was like, oh, this is cool. And oh, it's a thread. Oh, okay. Let me dig into the thread. She goes on to explain. I'm watching an interview he did with Seth Meyers. He's complaining about MQ season 2's 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes because the critics, she now capitalizes this, like the show wrong, she continues. They talk about the human elements too much and don't talk about the comedy, which she says is harder, ? But Jesus Christ, dude. People talk about the drama because they assume at a base level, it will be funny. Like that's bare minimum. She continues. Imagine Jesse Armstrong getting in a snip because people appreciate the bald-faced hilarity in Succession. She continues. And don't get me started on him saying that comedy is harder than creating realistic characters and relationships. Capitalize. If people knew how to do the latter, TV and movies would be better. She continues. I should not get this riled before bed.
That's some good points.
Not only are they great points, I was laughing through the whole thing because, as I said in our follow-up conversation, Libby, like seriously, no one is sicker of hearing my voice and seeing me push this television show than I am right now. So I can definitely empathize with where you were at 11:45 at night that
it's
night.
It's not even that late.
Or well, it's late enough to get that upset before you go to bed.
We were prepping to talk to Seth the next day, this all happened.
I wanted to reach out. So I reached out to Libby and to say, first of all, I thought that was great. And she's dead right. It's so annoying to have somebody on a talk show complaining about 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. I think what I was just trying to, I guess, explain from my point of view, what we were trying to do is like, you know, those talk shows are comedy beats, and so you're trying to come up with like fun sketches that you can talk about. And I thought, well, it might be fun if I start with the punchline, and the punchline would be like, nobody respects Seth Meyers and he gets it, which is obviously opposite the truth, but it's always fun to give the host a little shit. And then if we walk backwards from that, then I can maybe suggest that he knows what it feels like to be disrespected simply because you make comedy, and that we are sort of looked as a second tier form of entertainment, that it's easy to do comedy, and really where the most important stuff is done is in drama. And then from there, we were doing some tongue in cheek stuff. So, but nevertheless, it was irritating, and I'm sure you weren't the only one that was irritated by it.
But like all comedy, there's this huge nugget of truth in that whole sketch, which is comedy is universally underappreciated by the industry writ large. Go, Libby.
Yeah. The most embarrassing thing about all of this is that Rob and I like totally agree, which is horrifying if you think about it, and kind of encapsulates the internet in a nutshell. But he's totally right. And I will go further and say, I am bad at comedy. Like, I'm bad at jokes. Like, I am not good without a studio audience that are reacting to things. And honestly, I couldn't tell if Seth was in on it. He seemed very thrown by it. Like, you deliver straight face so well. You play drama so well, Rob. And you. It's what made me realize you were an actor. But beyond that, no, so that's the thing. And like, Ben and Leo watched the same interview and they're like, oh yeah, this is funny. I was like, oh fuck. Fucking hate you guys. So yes, but silver lining, we all love the show. Silver lining, I think you're great and a huge talent comedically and otherwise. And now we get to talk about it.
So we're going to put out more content where people have to hear my voice push this show. Right. But you know what? Right. I'm sick of myself, but I'm definitely not sick of talking about Mythic Quest.
Well, I would just, speaking of talking about other people, I'd love to talk about Megan Gann's directorial episode 5. Just because I feel like for a bottle episode like that, like, it proves how amazing the show has gotten over the course of, at that point, 1.5 seasons, plus the 2 bonus episodes. But essentially, that, like, we want to spend that hour just chilling in this room with this cast of characters. I guess, like, what was that process like for that episode from the jump, and then, you know, Megan taking the reins?
Yeah, well, one thing we've found with Sunny is that you never know what people are going to respond to. So you can never, I think it's always dangerous to sit in a writer's room and think, well, what will the audience like? Not because we're not trying to make people happy or make people laugh or please people. Of course, we want people to like our stuff. But if you're chasing down someone else's expectation, you're just going to fail every time, especially since you have millions and millions of people who are watching. And for each person, they like different aspects of the show if they're watching the show at all. However, if you are watching Sunny, for example, what we found was what become oftentimes people's audience's favorite episodes are very simple episodes where we're just sitting in the bar talking. We have a bottle episode where we never leave an environment for various reasons. And what we found is because over the years, you develop a relationship with those characters, and sometimes just seeing them all together in one space, interacting with one another, becomes really fun. And yet generally you have to earn that over the course of, especially with a show like Sunny, which is, I think, an acquired taste. And I think right off the bat, I think is difficult for people to get into. I think it takes some time to develop a taste for Sunny. At least that's my experience. Whereas with Mythic Quest, I think, yes, of course, you want to get to know the characters. It takes a little time to understand, you know, what the dynamics are and who these people are and how they relate to one another and what the setting is. Nevertheless, I think we felt like by episode, whatever that is, 12 or 14, 15, that we had earned the episode where we're locked in and all speaking directly to one another. Very rarely are all the characters in one scene at one time. I think we've only done it one other time. And so it's a challenge because you can't leave the confines of that room. But if you've set up the right character dynamics, it's really, really fun, both to break, to write, to shoot, and to edit.
Well, can you talk a little bit, just on my end, again, like speaking to the joy as a viewer of those bottle episodes, so much of it does come from just seeing everybody in the room and kind of the quick back and forth that they have with each other and those kind of, you know, just almost tactile dynamics that are created. How much of it is done in breaking the episode in the writer's room, like of trying to, you know, work out that level of communication and, you know, how people are going to interact, as well as the timing of the lines and the jokes and everything, versus, you know, when you get to set and you get to, you know, have the people in the room already, when you get to do the thing that the episode's about and built around, how does that kind of break down?
Well, one thing that I've always been a big advocate of, and that's just because the only other writer's room I'd ever been in was Sunny, is having performer writers in the writer's room. And so just in our own writer's room this season, we've got myself, David Hornsby, who plays David Brittlesby, Ashley Birch, Humphrey Carr, who plays Tall Paul. And then on top of that, I like to invite the actors in. So we had a number of the actors that would come in 2-3 times a week. Jesse was in there quite a bit. Imani came in quite a bit. Charlotte would come in from time to time. And so that really gives us an advantage because we can be there in the room acting things out and pitching things and talking about it and pitching jokes, but also seeing the chemistry and how the dynamics play out. We also have the benefit of having shot an entire first season, so we can see the chemistry that had already flourished and then been fostered through the back half of season one, and then even the first half of season two. So we had a good sense of how things would play, but then you want to allow for on the day adjustments and things to change. But generally, when you get that far down the road, yes, you can play with dialogue, but you don't want to change intention. Because if you start changing intention in the middle of a scene, all of a sudden that has a domino effect down the rest of the narrative, and all of a sudden things start falling apart. So, you know, when people say, oh, well, do you guys improvise? The truth is, yes, we do to an extent. We'll improvise lines of dialogue, but we'll never improvise intent, because that changes the narrative.
I mean, you were talking a little bit about, you know, when people watch a show, they all have different favorite things. I'd have to say that one of my favorite things is the relationship between Ian and Poppy, especially how it seems to expand and contract, and it's a little bit volatile. How has that been with you and Charlotte sort of growing that relationship? How has it changed, and has it ended up somewhere you weren't expecting it to when you started in season one?
Yes. Well, first of all, right off the bat, Charlotte was not cast originally as Poppy. She was cast as another character. And we were looking for Poppy. Poppy was significantly older, more of a peer of Ian's, and they had been working together for a very long time. The first episode was dramatically different, to be honest with you, than what we wound up airing. But every time we read many, 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 many actresses for Poppy, and a lot of them were fantastic, but something just wasn't quite clicking. And I just had this feeling. I was like, having read with Charlotte a few times for Dana, which was the original character that she was playing well before we met Imani, I'm like, I feel like there's an interesting dynamic between the two of us, but I would change the character a little bit. But I felt like there was chemistry, and I felt like I knew that when you find someone that you have chemistry with, or you find two actors that have chemistry with each other, then you kind of throw out your preconceived notions of what the character should be or what the script is, because you never want to force an actor to adapt to a character, because that strips the humanity away from it. It's got to be the opposite. You have to make the character adapt to the actor. And that's what we did. So we completely rewrote that whole first episode, and it was basically based on the fact that Charlotte and I had this really interesting dynamic, and that was on screen with dialogue, but behind the scenes it's also a part of the developing relationship between Megan Gans and I, who have been working together now for a number of years, but we have a very specific relationship, and it's not the same as Ian and Poppy. However, it is a very, it's a very intense and very, very close relationship, and it's very, it's based in obviously a working respect for each other, a very deep friendship, but recognizing that we are work colleagues, but we're also really great friends. Our families are very close to one another. Her husband is a very close friend of mine. She's a very close friend of Caitlin's. It's a very specific dynamic. And I don't know that I've ever had that kind of dynamic with with a woman before in a work environment, a non-romantic relationship that is still that close. And of course I have friends like that, but very rarely do you find yourself at work having relationships like that. And so we thought, well, it's a very healthy relationship. And it's interesting when I present it to other people because they realize that they don't have those kinds of similar relationships, or maybe they have one in their life. And we thought, well, that's pretty unique. Like maybe we can mine from that and tell the story of these two people that have a very specific relationship that maybe you haven't seen before or don't see very often.
I thought a lot about this, probably more than I should. And I've really felt like it would be a very difficult thing to mine that relationship into a fictional form, like to try to have those conversations with somebody about what makes your relationship so unique and what makes it tick and what makes it work. And then like mapping that onto characters who are trying to do the same thing without, you know, creating a lot of friction in real life, without creating like, you know, like saying something about how, well, I really think that you do this and that's a strange thing. And then the defensive nature comes up. How did you kind of break through those walls? And then what are those conversations like as you continue to try to map the characters forward? Like, are they still staying fairly close to some of the dynamics that you share, or are they now becoming kind of their own people?
Yeah, it's very much like the way that you approach any character. So any character I've ever played has aspects of who I am, but they're not me, right? Like even the character on Sunny, who is an abhorrent, narcissistic, sociopathic, you know, cartoon character, the reason that it still resonates as funny to us is that there are aspects of that character that unfortunately are part of my condition or part of who I am. And it's hard to point to an actor and not see, because this is the body that I'm working with. So there's a certain amount of the way I express myself that would be extreme versions of, say, the best and worst versions or the extreme versions of the best and worst aspects of my personality. And I think all writers are like that too, that where every character you write is still, no matter how much you try to get into somebody else's point of view or somebody else's voice, it's still an expression of yourself. And so I think it's the same. We approach it the same way, which is that Ian is not me, but sort of the things that I abhor about myself or aspects of myself or the darker parts of my personality, I like to exploit in that character just because I think it's interesting to mine for comedy and for personal introspection and growth and progression for myself. But also I just think it's an interesting character and he has an interesting character traits. Same thing with Poppy. Poppy is not Meg and Poppy is not Charlotte. And Poppy is a character that doesn't really exist, but is an amalgam of so many different aspects of all three people, myself, Meg, Charlotte, and then also all of the other writers in the room and the directors, and we're creating this sort of all together. So even though it feels as though it might cross into difficult conversation, and of course it does, writers' rooms sometimes can become difficult, we have a certain level of intimacy, Meg and I, and a free form of communication that we can navigate that pretty well. And I think from a pretty healthy perspective, unlike Poppy and I.
Well, I love the idea of like putting a character on as like a light coat, as opposed to like creating something whole cloth. But I did want, before we got too far afield from Libby's tweets, I do think that, like I said, there is a huge nugget of truth in what you were saying on the show, which is that for whatever reasons, comedy doesn't get the respect it probably deserves on the whole. And not to say that I think we're all sort of in agreement. I think comedy is much more difficult than I think drama is. I think when I worked, and this is a very specific example, but when I worked at The Onion and we were bought by a major news organization and they saw how much some things cost, they're like, why can't you just make it the way that we make X? And it's like, because A, you're not world building. and B, it's just like, it takes time. You need to write, you need to hone, you need to shoot it and do multiple takes of a thing. It's not just like throwing to a dude in the studio to be like, here's the sound bite, and then you can roll the throw to B-roll. And the idea is like, and granted, that's news versus comedy as opposed to drama versus comedy. But the general idea sort of holds that comedy takes maybe a little bit extra work that people, for whatever reason, do not give it credit for. And I was wondering if obviously you have thoughts on this, but like where this is coming from or where you're seeing it most.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to suggest that making drama is easy, because it certainly isn't. None of this is easy, especially to make it well. So it's hard for me to sit here and say, well, making comedy is harder than it is to make drama. I would just say that comedy is just much more specific. So there is not a global agreed upon set of precepts that like everybody can recognize that we all share as far as comedy goes, because oftentimes comedy doesn't necessarily transcend culture. In fact, it's oftentimes specific to culture. So right off the bat, it becomes a little bit more niche. What makes you laugh isn't necessarily what makes somebody else laugh versus what makes somebody else laugh. Whereas if you want to make somebody cry, you know, if you kick a dog on screen, people are going to have a visceral reaction all over the world. And it's going to horrify people, right? So that we share. From a pathos perspective, you know, falling in love, being in love, losing someone you love, those are all things we share. So though, in terms of like, when you go to the narrative well to figure out how I'm going to tell my story, you know, well, if we need the audience to feel a certain way about this, we know we can go to that well. Unfortunately, with comedy, we just don't have as deep of a well. We don't have all of those things that we share. So already it just becomes a little bit more niche. And then on top of that, we still have the same challenges of breaking a compelling narrative, something that somebody wants to sit through for 30 minutes. But on top of that, we also have to figure out how to make it funny. Now, I'm not asking for people to feel sorry for people in comedy or to play the tiniest violin.
We already feel sorry for people who work in comedy. Don't worry about that part.
Okay, like, great.
That's just built in. But
great. Sorry. Well, yes, but that's because I would assume mostly because you feel compassion for the pain that they feel that was inflicted upon them earlier in their life, which drove them into comedy. I see all the time. But what I would say is, I'm not suggesting that anybody that works in the field of comedy deserves any more credit than or respect than those in drama. It pains me when I see, read, feel, hear that somehow drama is considered more important. It's almost like people they'd rather feel sad and depressed sometimes, or horrified, or devastated, or elated because of love, than to laugh. And I just don't see that in everyday life. It feels to me like most people, like when they go home and they're happy, they're laughing, and if they've enjoyed the day, if they're at a work meeting, or if they're in their car, or they're with their friends, when you're sitting around with your friends and you're having drinks, you know, if everybody's crying, you're probably not having the best time, but if everybody's laughing, it seems like you're having a pretty good time. And so shouldn't that be held in the same esteem as something dramatic? Whenever I hear people say like, no, I think it is, all you have to do is look around and see what the best picture, you know, nominations are every year, or even just the best drama in the Emmys or what have you is always considered the big award. You know, the comedy is like, that's just what the clowns do. And so, look, do I lose sleep over this? No, of course not. Libby does, because she was up until midnight tweeting about it. But
it's working.
That's early. That's early for Libby. She's not a morning person. She's a night owl. That's fine.
But when I get a chance every once in a while, especially on a comedy show with Seth or other people who I think feel it too, I think it's just always fun to bring up.
No, it absolutely is. And this is a thing that Ben and I have talked about over and over. And Rob, I mentioned this to you when we spoke. You know, I asked Ben a few months ago, like, how do you fix comedy? Or how do you fix what is happening in something like the TV Academy, where sometimes comedies aren't funny and sometimes comedies aren't trying to be funny. And while I think it's impossible to like legislate that, it doesn't seem like an even playing field. And I have to say, if it does you any personal, Jesus Christ, words, please cut all of this out. If it helps at all, I watched maybe one drama during the pandemic and everything else was comedy because I needed comedy to get me through the day, and including Mythic Quest like 6 times. But I think people have trouble respecting that because it's their best friend. It is that person that they want to hang out with, the person that you want to spend time with. They feel, because it's hard to watch drama, they think it's like homework, that they have accomplished something when you watch The Wire again. Congratulations, Leo. But when I go back and watch 30 Rock 16 times, it soothes me, and sometimes I think that's more valuable. It's not fair, but I know it means more to me.
I think that's interesting. Like the idea, I've never thought about it like that, where it's the mystique that's associated with this thing that's dramatic, mysterious. Maybe it's something I'm trying to figure out. Either way, it's dark. It feels like a little bit more work, as opposed to which of course, when you have something like that, a relationship with a person or a book or a movie or anything like that in your life, a song, that feels a little bit less tangible and maybe less easy to sort of understand and less comfortable, which maybe in some way you conflate that with it being like more important. Whereas your best friends, who you take for granted, the people who are the ones who are closest in your life, who you know the most, who you are actually the most intimate with and have the most respect for and love the most, you don't necessarily have that relationship as it pertains to like mystique. And so if it's not being held at arm's length, it doesn't feel as something, I don't know, something that feels as important to you.
I would also say that the best comedies are about relationships with people that you recognize yourself in or your friends in, and they are people you want to come back a time and time again to hang out with. So, you know, they're your crew. If I'm watching Breaking Bad, I'm never going to be a science teacher who gets into being a drug lord. And if I watch Mad Men, it's not very likely that I'm going to go back to the 60s and experience extreme and horrible sexism. But you know, those are fantasy, and comedy mm-hmm. is real.
And it's interesting that you brought up those two shows, because Vince, at different points of that show's run and Sonny's run, I got a call from Vince. I got a call from Matt Weiner, and amongst a few other shows, and they'd say, you know, when the writers are all sitting around and we're talking about breaking stories, what winds up happening is eventually we start talking about Sonny. And I said, really, why? And they said, I don't know, we just have a few writers on the show and they've evangelized everybody and people are now like watching it and talking, which of course makes us feel fantastic because we're getting the respect of our peers and we love those shows as well, right? We love to hear that Vince Gilligan and the people that wrote Breaking Bad, or Matt Weiner and the people that wrote Mad Men, you know, love Sonny, because we hold them in such high esteem. And then they're saying the same thing to us. The difference is that the industry does not feel the same way. Now, again, it's going to sound like I'm complaining, and I'm really not. I'm actually just more interested in it. I think it's just kind of fascinating. And look, at the end of the day, I'm certainly not going to be the one that's going to sit here and start talking about, well, what is comedy and how do you define comedy? And like, at the end of the day, our shit is our shit. Our shows are our shows. And people want to make whatever they want to make. And the only reason that I think that the conversation is important is because you of all people know that these awards really do matter. And having these conversations really do matter. And Barry Jenkins was just talking about this. And he was talking about how, like, you know, are millions of people going to see Moonlight if it doesn't get nominated and eventually win Best Picture? No, no. There's a reason why people went out and sought that movie. And you see the giant spikes when these conversations start talking about what's going to be awarded. Is it ego stroking? Of course. Is it slapping ourselves on the back? Of course. Is the pageantry of it all absolutely ridiculous? Yes. And we can all recognize that. But at its core, it really is valuable to talk about what we value culturally, what we all consider collectively as art, and the things that we celebrate and the things that we agree on are good and progressing us forward, progressing our industry forward, progressing our culture forward, progressing the art form forward. And so when you get left out of those kinds of conversations, it really harms a lot of shows that should be watched. And that's unfortunate because we're talking about all these other shows and these other shows that are just as valuable aren't being talked about because the criteria by which we're quote unquote judging them seems to be deviating further away from what the original intention of what a comedy was. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. Go make your show, go be whatever you want. But at the very least, if you are in the business of categorizing or delineating what is what, there should still be some like modicum of agreement that if that intent matters, that if you are not intending to be funny, that's totally fine. You're making a drama, right? And so when you start having these conversations of what are the best comedies this year, again, not to take away from any show that's not trying to be funny, but that's okay. You've made a drama. And so let's put you into that category for the sake of this conversation. Again, if you're having conversations about categories, which that's what we're doing right now.
Well, we are always. Yes. I mean, let me say this. I love television. I wouldn't have taken this job as TV awards editor if it was just glitz and glamour and getting to glad hand with celebrities. I do it because I need people to see the best shows on television, and they aren't. This is my opportunity to say, you have got to drop everything and watch Pen 15. You have to drop everything and watch Mythic Quest. You have to drop everything and watch P-Valley. Not that anyone listens because my Twitter feed is awful. So many rants, but awards do matter. And when we pretend like they don't, or we pretend that they're happening in a vacuum, it does everyone a disservice. That's my
rant over.
Five. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I do think that, like, in terms of the conversation and what we're like actually talking about when we talk about these shows, that is part of the issue. Like, not to bring it all back to the Seth Meyers interview, but the part when you talked about how critics were reviewing the show and so many of the reviews weren't necessarily about it being a comedy or weren't necessarily about it being funny. You know, it's something that I thought about and I think about a lot when I write about comedies, because it is very hard to write about comedy strictly from saying, well, this is funny. Like, there's only so many ways to say over and over again, this is really funny, to the point where, like, Leo and I have talked about a video series where I'm literally explaining jokes to people, where I'm like, I love this joke so much that I want to make a video showing how they did it, because it's so amazing that they were able to pull this off. But when the conversation, you know, when you want to emphasize this show is great, or you want to emphasize you need to watch this, you start looking for other things to talk about. You start looking for other elements of the show where you're like, well, not only is it funny, but it's also important. Like, there's also something significant here. And that's where the valuation tends to get skewed. So I think when we do talk about comedies, it's important to, you know, try to respect what they're trying to do. And when we're talking about all things, it's important to respect what they're actually going after and then talk about whether or not they succeed about, you know, hitting those goals. And for me, if you can just give some tips about talking about comedy, that would be great. Thanks.
Well,
what jokes are funny?
Well, like, to in Libby's rant there, one of the things that did actually like truly resonate with me was when she said, look, dude, comedy, like it being funny is like base level. So like, yeah, we're assuming that your comedy is going to be funny, dude. So now what are we going to judge it on afterwards? And I think that's totally valid, but that is from your perspective and you actually do feel that way. I don't think that the vast majority of people do think that way. I think that they're looking at something and saying, well, no, I'm connecting with this on a very human level and on a very dramatic level. Again, I have to keep stressing and I have to continue to keep putting these caveats in that's fantastic. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. If I'm being honest, my favorite shows are drama. I always thought that was because I work in comedy all day long and I'm just like bored of it and I'm sick of it when I go home. There are a lot of comedies I love, but like the dramatic shows are the ones that I sort of gravitate towards to it at night. So I'm certainly by no means like slagging off drama, but if we're talking about what people are like expecting first in their comedy, when they're talking about it as being high art, I don't think the intent of making somebody laugh actually is a base level.
Which is bullshit.
It's wild.
People look, we talk often about how everyone is wrong except us and doesn't know how to do things. I mean, I feel like it's one of our main topics of conversation.
Leo, you're in good company, Rob, because I think I remember I was at an interview for Taika Waititi last year when he was on a tour, and he said something along the lines about comedy and drama. And he's like, he essentially said, you know, comedy is easier in its execution, or is harder in its execution, because to do good drama is like, I just have to create a base level of like, this is a realistic relationship. You believe what is happening is happening. Comedy is doing that and then adding an additional layer of like, now make it funny. So like it's a second layer, and the reverse just be like, to do drama is just sort of slopping the humor off of the top of comedy. Now granted, it's not all comedies, there's obviously various genres within comedy, but the idea being that doing two things at once, making it believable and making it funny, is a more difficult task, which I think, as Libby's Twitter rant says, like Mythic Quest is doing in spades.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, but the good news is, again, before I cry too far foul, if you look at the last, like, let's just say 10 years, where I think there has been a much more of a proliferation towards 30-minute dramas that whose intent really is to wrap you up in the drama and then kind of casually make you chuckle from time to time. And look, Libby brought up the Succession, which is both the best drama on TV and the best comedy. So like, I think they should win all the awards personally. And I'm sure if you ask them, like, what are you intending to do? I think he'd probably tell you to fuck off. I'm making my show, which is great. And that's why that show's so fantastic. But I'll say that even in the last 10 years, as things are pushing in that direction, I think really when it comes down to it, the shows that are being singled out still continue to be the funniest shows. I mean, it's undeniable that Schitt's Creek is funny. And even if it's not your cup of tea, you recognize that they are trying to be funny, right? I mean, Sunny, for example, again, it's been critically lauded for its entire run, but it never like hit the mainstream Hollywood zeitgeist. Nevertheless, it might not be for you, and I totally understand why. It's clear that we're trying to be funny. And it's been rewarded for that with the longest running tenure of any sitcom of all time. So there's still plenty of space for, you know, for shows like Veep, where that just like kept crushing every year after year, Modern Family. And those are shows that were obviously trying to make you laugh. And that obviously makes us all feel pretty good. I just wish that in a part of that same conversation, and movies specifically, that people would understand that they just have an equal amount of value. That's all.
Well, we all back you, man.
Yeah. Now to ask a very stupid question.
Yes.
When I was at Clickhole, we tried to get a video game off the ground called PD's Pockets, where you were a character who in this open world who just had to walk around picking things up forever. Like there was,
Jesus
that was
Christ.
That was the goal. And you just got, and your pockets got bigger and bigger and wider, and they eventually left the screen. It was impossible to find an affordable video game company to help us make this. How is your relationship with Ubisoft and making all those interstitials and anything that's like game pertinent?
It's great. I mean, they've made it possible for us to make the show. I mean, we wanted to make sure that at the very least that it felt authentic to the experience of being a game developer, that we knew we couldn't get everything right. It's still a television series and it's a comedy. But we wanted developers and people that worked in the industry, and then also by extension, just the people in the gaming community, the gamers themselves, that it felt like, oh, okay, I know what they're going for. This feels authentic to my experience. Is it exactly right? No, but they took the effort to make sure that they were making it feel as accurate as possible. And that's where Ubisoft came in, because we just talked to so many different people and continue to do so, who are experts in their fields. So we have a great relationship with them.
The jump in the interstitials from season one to season two was outstanding. What happened there?
Well, in the first season, you actually see a version of this happen quite a bit. Nobody wants to bet on your show in the beginning. They think it's going to be a failure, or they think you're going to make fun of them, which actually is totally fair, because so many different shows in the past about video games have basically derided the culture, and which we obviously are not doing. And yet, so when we reached out to other gaming studios and said, hey, would it be okay if we used some of your interstitial gaming clips as pieces of the show, would you let us do that? And it would be mutually beneficial. And we just got no left and right. And Ubisoft was one of the only ones that allowed us to do that. But then after the first season aired and people, it got such an overwhelmingly positive response, specifically in the gaming industry, then everybody started calling back and saying, okay, we want to be a part of this.
Like big pimping now.
I assume that you're getting a lot of feedback on Derek Waters' character, Phil. Like people are like, yeah, that is my life. That is what I do.
Yes. I mean, the truth is that there is a version of that relationship and that character and that department in so many different industries. And ours is one of them. And that I'm very cognizant of, but I do see a lot of people that aren't. And I have to admit, I'm guilty of being a version of Ian in that situation. Because, you know, the ship is moving and it's moving fast. And you have to just like, okay, go to work, Phil, like work your magic and deliver. And I don't necessarily have time to get like granular in the details, but don't worry about it. We'll just fix it later. And you realize that you're putting people off oftentimes onto a fool's errand, but it's really difficult to navigate all of these things at the same time. And so I had a lot of people reach out to us from the art departments of various studios and say, that feels exactly like my experience. And the other character is Sue. I mean, Sue's based on a real person and a real job. Now she's probably the broadest character in the show besides David. but it's a real, that is a real job. And the person I talked to was actually really dark. And we were like, that's gonna be sad. This guy was like really dark because he's just dealing with the worst, the dregs of the internet, of people just like hammering the community manager about what they hate. Nobody reaches out to the community manager to talk about how much they love the game. It's like a really toxic one-way communication. And so we thought, that's gonna be too sad to present somebody like that. What if we just went the opposite direction, where she's just like switched something off in her brain and can accept that level of toxicity and still manage to like be positive. We thought that'd be an interesting character to play with.
I mean, I think the real brilliance there is the moments where it flips back on, like when the group of little girls in gaming come in and Sue's just like, no, stay away. Like that touched me deep inside. Yeah, but now I want to start a separate project, which is just emailing community managers and inter major games and just be like, you're doing a great job. Like,
yeah,
thanks for what you do.
It would make their day, because it would be the one email that they got, I think, for that day that would be super positive. But, you know, I think it's kind of interesting. And again, this is not me. This is actually not me complaining about super positive reviews. However, it's fun. I bring this up because I, like you, Libby, like I love television. I love talking about it. I love watching it. I grew up. It's been a huge part of my life, my whole life. And I love spreading, not only spreading the word of what other great shows are out there, but I also love dissecting what it is that makes great shows. And then also why it is that people like something. I'm way more interested in that than why people dislike something. So like if somebody like says, oh, Mythic Quest is a piece of shit, or, you know, and I hate it, I just disregard it because that's just an opinion. I know it's not a piece of shit. I work on it and I know what a piece of shit is, and it might not be for them, but it still has validity out in the world. Or if they say like, oh, I just hate Ian's character, I'm like, okay, fine. There's a million reasons as to why you might hate my character, and it's like less interesting to me. But when people like something, but they like it for different reasons, I find that interesting because it's constructive. It's like, oh, right, that gives me some guidance into the way that the show is being viewed. So for example, Ben could not have written a more glowing review of the show. However, backstory, which by far and away is the best reviewed episode by the fan base, he was like a meh for him. And I just find that fascinating. Like, I'd be interesting to hear, and I don't know how you felt about it, Libby. I think you might have agreed with him, which is interesting. I'm interested to hear from your perspective, not only what it was about that episode that you were met about versus what you love about the rest of the show, and then why do you think that is?
And see, I'm the exact opposite of you. I am very, I want to know what people dislike. It is super triggering for me to dislike something that everyone else likes. Cause I'm like, what the fuck did I do? I screwed it all up. Like, I don't know. I don't know how to watch TV. Like, I legitimately walked around for 3 days being like, I don't know. Maybe I don't understand what's funny. Maybe I don't know how to watch TV. I did not enjoy backstory. And there are plenty of little reasons. One reason is when you're doing a 10 episode season and you commit two episodes to this character who is kind of very much been on the periphery in the first two seasons, that's a fifth of the show. And if I don't connect with that arc, which clearly was not a problem for most people, then I am out, that I'm out of the loop. And when we return in episode 9 to sort of episode 8, when we return, I'm a little lost. Because it's been a while since we've seen those characters. And I'm guessing that's true of people who are watching on a weekly basis as well. Not to throw anyone under the bus here, but I think Leo said it best. Earlier today, he said something about CW's character. And he drew a parallel to Creed Bratton from The Office. And he said, I don't want to see how Creed Bratton became Creed Bratton. I just want to luxuriate in his fucking weirdness. So I think that CW was a character that never really connected for me. And keep in mind, I'm married to a woman who loved the episode. She thought it was great. And so there have been many teary arguments on my part about it.
Harry or teary?
Yes, exactly. Asshole. But I don't want to watch shows about men who are shitty and succeed and are shitty. And like, I don't, in the past few years, I've gotten very selective about the kinds of shows I ingest. I came really, really late to Ted Lasso because I was like, oh, here's a fucking nice Kansaser to doesn't exist because fucking Trump, and he's just gonna come in and everyone's gonna love him and it's gonna be great, and it's just like another white guy saves the day, all men on the cast. I'm a little jaded. It's been a rough 4 years, 5 years. It's been a rough life. So it was giving over this show in which I adore the ensemble and the comedy, and I lost it. I don't know. I loved, unlike Ben, the standalone in the first season because it was one episode and it filled out a backstory nebulously about the building. It wasn't any of my main characters' pasts. So it was a fun adventure into sort of something that we never would have seen otherwise. I get having F. Murray Abraham. Always love F. Murray Abraham. But CW wasn't really the person I wanted to know more about. He wasn't the guy that I wanted to delve into the backstory of. Like, how did Poppy end up in her job? Like, how did she, what was her path to this? Because it's still hard to be a woman in certain things. God, I've talked forever. Will someone else say something, please?
I didn't know when to interrupt, Libby.
Oh, God, I know. I just like, I'm sorry. I didn't like it. I don't like disappointing people. Yeah, but so what I love about the show is the ensemble. What I love is the fact that they're all dorks, but there's so many different flavor of dorks. Like even an Ian is a dork, like with his facial hair and his fancy cars, and you know, he's a dork for masculinity.
Can I suggest that I'm not trying to be defensive at all, but because I totally appreciate your answer. And I'm not trying to talk you into liking something you don't like, but can I suggest too that CW is also a dork, and that what we're trying to do oftentimes with the show is to present something unexpected. And I think ultimately, I hope that's a strength of the show, that
yeah.
We're not going to keep delivering the same thing week after week, even though we love the ensemble as well. And we love the traditional model of sitcom. I grew up watching it and love it. And I love The Office and I love workplace comedies, but I also love the idea of maybe playing with the form and suggesting that we had this character who I knew, we talked about at great length, was probably the character that the least amount of people would want to empathize with and to understand where and how he got to where he got to. Because at the end of the day, it's a fine line between presenting a case for why somebody is who they are and that razor thin line of justifying why he behaves the way he does. And so one, we hope fosters empathy and compassion, which we would suggest should transcend anyone and everyone. Everybody is deserving of that. However, where that line gets crossed is when you use the empathy and compassion to justify that anybody's behavior at any given time is appropriate. And so that's where we're like, we were really careful with CW. So it's interesting that you say that the reasons you didn't like it were almost the exact reasons why we made it. And so at the end of the day, that's, I think, and I hope part of why Sunny, I think, is successful and for as long as it has been, because we have episodes that fans like straight up hate, like truly hate, because we take a big swing. And I would venture to say that I think that the reason that the show works in a long term is that we take big swings and we piss people off sometimes, including the people that love us the most, because you just don't know what you're going to get. And I kind of like that about the way that we approach, you know, making the show. And I like the fact, not that you care about this at all, but I like that someone who loves the show doesn't like all of them, if that makes sense.
No,
I think it's kind of cool.
I actually like it too, because it reminds me of all the things that I love about the show. It forces me to examine myself and the biases that I'm bringing it to it. It forces me to contemplate a series, which is, I mean, honestly, there's obviously something I love to do. Like that's the whole thing. That's the whole job. So it upsets me because of my own personal issues. But yeah, I think, I don't think the show did anything wrong. I just didn't like it.
Yeah.
Because I rewatched it with Emily actually. And she, I watched it with an open mind and obviously it's gorgeous. Like, It's spectacular. It's so finely wrought, finely drawn. It is exactly what it wants to be. I don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Boys, how do you feel about it?
I, as a Midwesterner, am deeply uncomfortable with confrontation. So
this
think
is the fucking worst.
Libby absolutely did a great job illustrating my problems as well as what I wrote in the review, which is hopefully enough. But I think it's more important to key in on what you're saying in regards to identifying the things that you love about a show when something doesn't connect with you. Like, one of the hardest things that I have, when the harder thing for me is explaining why a show is great as opposed to why a show doesn't work. When it's fairly easy to talk about why something doesn't work. And I think if you are only talking about one or the other, then you're not really doing anybody any favors. Like, you need to try to engage with things on their own terms, as well as, you know, try to add a perspective to it that other people may not have. And when I watched that episode, just like when I watched the one in season one, the standalone of season one, I recognized in the moment, I was like, I think I'm going to be alone here. I think this is just going to be me out here not fully loving this. And I just have to be okay with that. So I'll just sit here. I'm trying to be okay with it. I'm trying to get
there. Well, it's interesting that you started by saying that you're uncomfortable with confrontation, because do you consider this confrontation?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, really?
110%. Yeah.
Like, anytime
in the Midwest,
I don't want to tell somebody who created something that the thing that they created, I didn't like it, or it doesn't work for me, or, you know, in broad terms, it's bad. Like, I never want to even say the words "it's bad." That just is
not one. It's inaccurate.
It's inaccurate for this especially, but it's also doesn't do any service to anybody I'm talking to, because the act of creating something and the act of putting something out there, especially as you talked about it, and as anyone who watches the show with any, you know, kind of thought can recognize, is that you're trying to do something different. Like, you're trying to give us something unexpected, which is what I've always valued about Sunny, which is what I've always valued about you as a creator in general. So for me to not like the thing that's unexpected, which in and of itself, in a broad sense, is what I appreciate, is very difficult for me to wrap my head around, and also to talk about with the person who did it, because I don't ever want you to stop doing it. I don't ever want that criticism to be like, hey, you know, check yourself. This isn't like you've gone outside of your lane. It's like, no, keep going, keep searching, keep creating.
Keep swinging.
I would say, well, first of all, I appreciate what you're saying. I don't take it as confrontation myself, but maybe it's because it's tempered by the fact that if this was maybe a more hostile conversation where I was talking to someone who was like, look, I just don't like any of this show. But then I would be like, I don't know why we're talking. Why we're talking about it, right? So it's tempered by the fact that you're basically saying, I really love this show. And in fact, you both, I mean, everybody here has been so effusive about it, that you're just saying, I don't like this one aspect of it. To me, that obviously makes it much easier to converse about. But beyond that, I guess a writer's room, you're spending all day long. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. Charlie, Glenn, and I just read a draft of an episode that I wrote for the new season yesterday. We threw out half of it. This is 15 years into this relationship. And they're like, look, Rob, I know you spent 5 hours doing this yesterday, but it's not good. It's not good enough, right? And so I'm so used to these kinds of conversations that I don't take them personally, because of course it's a personal conversation, because it's personal taste at a certain point. It's not mathematics. I'm basically saying, here's strawberry ice cream. Don't you like it? And you're like, oh, I don't like strawberry ice cream. I'm like, yes, but let me explain to you why it's so good. And you're like, well, okay, I'll taste it. And I'm like, well, taste it, right? Can't you taste what's so good about it? And you're like, yeah, but I don't like strawberry ice cream. What the fuck do you want from me? So I guess I just learned to divest myself from my ego, my ideas, and my creative output from my identity and my ego, because you'll just get crushed that way. Doesn't mean I don't want people to love everything I do, but when you're starting from a place of, I know that Glenn and Charlie respect me, I know that they love me, I know that we're working together, and that they just don't happen to love what I'm like, this thing, that's okay. That's good. Like, they didn't like the strawberry ice cream. I'll move on.
I think who doesn't like strawberry ice cream? Jesus Christ. I think there is another aspect to this, which spooks red journalists on the outside. I said, when I saw the episode, I was like, I don't know what I'm gonna do. Like, I hated this episode. And because, you know, Twitter always, you gotta amp everything up. Everything is the best or worst. But I was like, I didn't like this episode. I didn't like what it was doing, and everyone else loves it. And I don't understand. And someone responded to me with, well, that's all I need to hear. I was gonna truck it out, but now I won't. And I was like, fucking no, I fucking love this show. Like, it doesn't always have to be extreme, said the woman who said she hated something, a tweet before. But there is that fear that when you put those things out there, that it will get misconstrued and it will keep something from something you love, which is the exact opposite of what we're trying to do here. Being critical in the traditional sense, in public is a vulnerable thing, because there is a certain amount, there is a minuscule amount of power, and you want to wield it responsibly, and you don't want to be wrong, because that's embarrassing. And
but that is your job, right? I mean, and it's similar insofar as it's a creative output that you're putting out. You're putting your, I mean, my show is my opinion, right? Like, my, when you're seeing something, I'm presenting a story that is coming through me. And so of course I put a certain amount of my, of my own value into my ideas. So it is vulnerable. I do understand that. And in fact, that is kind of Ian's whole journey. Like, this whole second season, as we'll see in later episodes, it is him finally accepting that his vulnerability is something he has not reconciled with for his 43 years on this planet, and that he finally does in this, and it breaks him, you know. And so I think I'm personally in a constant state of trying to reconcile that with my own personal relationships, with my show, and with my relationship to the world. And it's just that social media makes it very difficult. It makes it very difficult because, like you said, you're just tweeting something. Who gives a shit? And it used to be, you would say that to your friend or your wife and be like, ah, I just, blah, 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 and then you go to bed, and then it wouldn't have any real implications because you kind of meant it, kind of didn't mean it. You were just joking, but you actually were pissed because we're messy and the world is messy and our mood is messy. And, you know, one day you feel like I hate something. And then the next day you're like, oh my God, I can't. You're my wife. I love you more than anybody in the world. But last night I wanted a divorce. That's just the way we are. Like, you know, like we're doing our best, but now it's on the public record forever.
It's very rude that you exposed the issues within my marriage, but fine. I'll just have
Leo. I was talking about my wife.
Oh,
we both, wow. Libby, we both have wives.
Boy, howdy.
Well, on the flip side, just to try to wrap this around a little bit toward the positive, I think that this result, though, that Libby tweeting what she tweeted, starting a discussion and having a creator respond to it in the way that you have, is kind of the ultimate goal for criticism. It's not that I want to, you know, write something and have a creator call me up or try to talk to me about it directly. It's that you hope that the conversation you're starting, whether it's with a review or with an interview or with a piece of analysis in any way, it's that it's contributing to the conversation of people who want to make things better. Like, the negative connotation attached to the word criticism is that you're just trying to tear things down, when in reality, I think we're all trying to build things up. I think we all just want things to be better. Like, we just want everything to be either its best self or to keep pushing people toward creating the thing that is their best self. And it's so exciting to see people respond to it like that, whether it's you or, you know, we've talked about Damon Lindelof in the past. Like, that's the kind of stuff that's the kind of people that I really enjoy hearing from, whether it's directly or through their art. So again, I think the tweets were probably a good thing in the long run.
I agree. I mean, I'm very much interested in engaging these kinds of conversations, specifically with journalists, because you are powerful. Even though Libby said you have a little bit of power, you have a tremendous amount of power, because you know, when things, especially now more than ever in the history of our business, because right now is the greatest time to be in the entertainment content business in so many ways, because there's so many opportunities, there's so many channels, there's so many streaming platforms, and there's so much more money, and people are now, people who have traditionally not had the ability to have their voice amplified now have that. The only problem with that is that there is so much content out there that everybody feels overwhelmed by it. And so where do we look to have all of that content curated? We look to you. So we're looking to people like you, people whose opinions we trust. And when you do see something on Twitter, or you read a great review, or you hear somebody who you respect on a podcast or on a radio or whatever, suggesting that some of this show is worthy of your time, when there are a million other shows out there, that is a really powerful tool that you have. And so I think from our perspective, the only thing that we hope as creators, of course we want you to like our shit, that of course we do, but we can't expect that. The only thing that we hope and expect is that you're holding yourselves to the same standard that you're expecting us to hold ourselves to, which is, I'm going to go into this and give this my best shot. I'm going to give my best self to this. I'm going to recognize when I don't like something because I had a bad day, or because I got cut off in traffic, or because, and I know that, you know, that people do that. They do that. Just like people on our side do that as well, but we're doing our best to make sure that we're really doing our best work to try to be as objective as we can in such a subjective, just by nature, a position that we're all in. And it's clear that you guys are doing that. And I'm not just saying that because you happen to love the show. I think it's the specificity of listening to the way you talk about it, that it's clear that you're doing the work to try to understand what we're going for, right? And that's awesome when you can read an article and be like, this is cool, because, and sometimes the articles aren't even like positive. It's more just like, oh, I see what they were going for here. And you're like, thank you. Thank you for putting in the effort to like try to understand, whether you liked it or not, to try to see what we're trying to do, as opposed to, I didn't like his face, or it didn't make me laugh, or I don't like that guy, or I don't like that woman. So I think I appreciate that.
As someone who once worked somewhere where the rate of attrition on headline submissions was 99%, I found none of this confrontational. This was, I could sense Ben and Libby's uncomfort the entire time.
I would, to be clear, say that, and I think Rob, we talked about this last time we talked, like, you have a very healthy disposition toward all of this, and I lack that healthy disposition. I just need to get where you are. So I guess just throw me in, like, I'll create a little writer's room with my friends and try to get feedback that way and see what I can do.
Libby does tell you suck all the time, Ben.
She's helping.
I will say this though, Rob, this podcast is never going to end, but not all creators are like you. Not all want that healthy engagement. And we get a little gun shy. My second TV piece that I published, the creator of the show, who was by all means a really good guy, wanted my email address so he could email me. And I was just this baby writer, and he was fine, but he was very, it scarred me a little bit, because there are those creators that are like, fuck you, you're a critic, like, you're just here to tear us down, you don't understand. And to a certain extent, there are those critics out there that do that. There are those that are not there to try and make TV great again or whatever, but it's not everyone is as willing to be vulnerable as you are, on both sides of the aisle. So it's a testament to the work you're doing on yourself or on your shows that you're able to converse like this in a dialogue. And God, it's fun. Like it's, I want to talk to every TV creator like this, because I love TV and I love people who make it. And God, isn't it a good time?
I agree. It's super fun. I'm happy to talk anytime. Hopefully we can all do it in person at some point soon over the next year. But yeah, I mean, I recognize, and I'll let you go. I recognize that sometimes it is a difficult position for you all to be in, because if you start developing personal relationships, or at least friendships, because I'm friends with a lot of writers and critics, and it becomes dicey, because it comes up where all of a sudden you're like, Libby, oh, I really like Rob, and oh, we're friends, and maybe we text every once in a while, but then he made something I didn't like. What am I supposed to do? And that's dicey. I recognize that. And so, again, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for anybody else. It's not something I was necessarily born with. It's something that I've had to be forced into and in the learning process, and to be consistently reminded of my ego getting in the way of my progression as a better person. And so any opportunity I can get to divest myself from that, I'll take. So sometimes, and very often, it's in the context of these conversations. So I'm happy to have it whenever you want. You know how to find it.
Thank you so much for spending time with us,
Rob. And you don't let us go. We let you go.
Okay. I mean, I think the important lesson to take away here is my tweets are great, and everyone should follow me on the Twitter.com.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, you got me.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good luck with the rewrite.
Thank you so much.
You shouldn't let poets lie to you.
Ain't nothing wrong with a couple of cold brews and a cool podcast.
Hey, Drew Scott here, and I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price, and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.